Nuclear Regulatory Commission is well on its way to approving what is supposed to be an interim consolidated waste storage site in New Mexico and or West Texas, just until they figure out that long-term problem about where they're going to put over 80,000 tons of dangerously radioactive plutonium-riddled fuel rods stuck at nuclear reactor sites around the country. But they've got nowhere to put it, no viable plan, and just a lot of hurry-up pressure to site the stuff in impoverished, mostly Spanish-speaking communities of color. So when you talk to a local indigenous activist who is fighting with all that's in her against this violation of logic, safety, and life, and she tells you,
here in New Mexico, we know that if they bring the waste here, it most likely will not be temporary. We might be dealing with a permanent waste site that was built with specifications to be temporary.
And then you learn that all of this radioactive waste across the country will have to be transported through more than 40 states to even get to the intended destination, putting everyone along the transportation corridor at risk. Well, that's when you wake up to the realization that no matter where you live, you are not safe from that life-threatening, very uncomfortable seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevy. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we bring you up to date on what's happening to force forward the establishment of two radioactive waste dumps in the American Southwest in an interview with two young, dedicated, did I say young, activists who founded the New Mexico-based Nuclear Issues Study Group, Leona Morgan and Eileen O'Shaughnessy. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information that can be found on any ballot initiative in the entire U.S. of A. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 13, 2020, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. First, a correction. In last week's late-breaking edition to the lead story on the workings of the nuclear football, we read a story from Democracy Now! That referred to two of President Trump's military aides who tested positive for COVID-19 as valets. These individuals do not simply carry around the 35-pound briefcase like they're railroad porters. They are highly trained individuals who are schooled in the range of their duties and responsibilities and all aspects of dealing with the launch codes that they are entrusted with. And dismissing them as simply valets was inappropriate. Basically, they are the last line of defense between Impulse and Armageddon, should it come to that. And we apologize for passing along that diminishing term. On to this week's news. Starting out with a story of international importance. According to research published in the journal Nature Energy, countries that adopted nuclear energy didn't actually reduce their carbon emissions a significant amount, but that countries with renewable energy investments did. Nuclear power is often promoted as one of the quote-unquote best ways to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels to generate the electricity that we need. But this new research suggests that going all in on renewables, such as wind and solar, might be a better approach to seriously reducing the levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. This was based on an analysis of 123 countries over a quarter of a century. and it showed that the adoption of nuclear power did not achieve the significant reduction in national carbon emissions that renewables did. And in some developing nations, nuclear programs actually pushed carbon emissions higher. According to the study's co-author, Andy Stirling, this paper exposes the irrationality of arguing for nuclear investment based on a do-everything argument. We will link to articles and this report on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 486. Back in 2015, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission pulled the plug on what was designed to be the best study of cancer near nuclear power plants that had ever been done. The pilot study's price tag was $8 million, which is a pittance in the NRC's $1 billion budget, and 5 years of work had already gone into it. But it was killed because officials were convinced that it would, quote-unquote, be too costly and couldn't link the reactors to disease. Or perhaps the opposite might have been the case, where it could prove it. In any event, last week a petition with some 1,200 signatures demanding that the study resume went to members of Congress representing Southern and Central California. Among other points the petition makes, the most recent research in the United States was carried out 29 years ago and is now considered heavily flawed and outdated. More recent studies in Europe have reported an increase in cancer risks for those living near nuclear power plants. The signature gathering was headed by the Samuel Lawrence Foundation. And what galls me is that this report in the Orange County Register had a headline that said, "Activists push Congress to revive probe into links between nuclear power plants and cancer." Why do they call them activists, which is a diminishing and demeaning term when used by the media? Just call them what they are: concerned citizens who are aware of nuclear dangers. And there is a powerful new article on regulatory capture, flying on the small modular reactor. And this is a real example of regulatory capture written by Arne Gunderson, who is a nuclear whistleblower and chief engineer at Fairwinds Energy Education. He points out that where small modular nuclear reactors are concerned, severe regulatory changes are being made within the NRC to facilitate growth within the atomic power industry. Not exactly protecting people and the environment, NRC. And of course, we'll link to this on the website. Over to Japan, where that country is still trying to convince the world that it's A-OK to dump radioactive water from Fukushima that has been stored on-site into the Pacific Ocean. While the International Atomic Energy Agency is throwing its weight behind dumping the water as being, quote-unquote, technically feasible, Japanese fishing industry representatives have come out in force to urge the government not to allow the release at sea of tons of contaminated water, saying it would undo years of work to restore their reputation. While Tokyo Electric Power Company claims that it will run out of storage room by 2022, they've been claiming that every year and keep pushing it about a year to 18 months into the future every time. But that is no reason to continue to pollute the Pacific Ocean with radioactive water. Fishing industry representatives have stated that any release of this water could promote other countries to reinforce restrictions on imports of Japanese fishery products, reversing a recent trend towards easing them. Not that anyone connected with Nuclear Hot Seat is still eating anything that has even touched the Pacific Ocean. Two towns in northern Japan, struggling with rapidly graying and shrinking populations, have signed up to possibly host a high-level radioactive waste storage site as a means of economic survival. Because nothing says short-sighted better than volunteering to host highly radioactive nuclear waste. The towns are Sutsu and Kamoine. Japan's nuclear regulator has approved Shikoku Electric Power Company's decommissioning plan for Unit 2 of its Ekata nuclear power plant, which is expected to take at least 40 years. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nut Nuts of the Week.
Japan's latest salvo in the propaganda campaign to make people forget that Fukushima ever had a nuclear meltdown comes from rice. In touting a new rice harvest in the coastal areas of Namie Town in Fukushima Prefecture for the first time since 2011, Japanese media has been referring to the rice as having been harvested in, quote, Fukushima's tsunami-hit area, end quote, and referred to it as an area where there was an earthquake and tsunami disaster in 2011 without a single reference to the nuclear disaster and the radioactivity that was not only released at that time, but still persists in the area. Deny, delete, do whatever you can, but don't do anything to remind people that there was a triple meltdown, three nuclear reactors that not only released radioactivity in the disaster, but that exploded and spewed plutonium that has been found up to 200 kilometers away. But that doesn't stop the propaganda machine in Japan from saying, eh, it's enough to mention the transient disasters of the earthquake and the tsunami and not get people upset about the ongoing consequences of the nuclear portion of the disaster. Because, hey, you gotta get those tourists in from the rest of the world when the Olympics maybe happen in 2021. Don't hold your breath. And that's why whoever came up with this rebranding of Fukushima, based once again on its rice, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numb Nuts of the Week.
In the UK, Downing Street is supporting plans to spend up to £2 billion of taxpayer money on up to 16 new small nuclear mini reactors. This initiative comes as the government's more conventional nuclear programs are mired in setbacks. And what makes you think the small ones are going to be any different? In Glasgow, Scotland, in mid-September, a nuclear warhead convoy estimated to be carrying six Trident weapons traveled right through the middle of town on its journey to England. This according to NukeWatch UK. And the northern German state of Lower Saxony has come out against Dutch plans to build up to 10 new nuclear power plants, one of which could be located near the German border. Lower Saxony's environmental minister, Olaf Lies, said he would focus on promoting joint renewable energy projects between the two countries. Germany will phase out its last nuclear power plants by the end of 2022 and is currently in the decade-long process of finding a permanent repository for the nuclear waste generated in the past 60 years. Aren't we all? We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, there are a ton of issues begging for our attention and involvement these days. COVID-19, the U.S. presidential election, global warming influenced wildfires, ice melt, and extreme weather events, international warmongering, I'm sure you've got your own personal list as well, that are making demands for your attention, pulling at your heart and soul, interrupting your sleep. It's hard to know where to put your attention, and I'll admit nuclear is rarely at the top of that list, but it deserves to be there, because bombs around the world are on hair trigger alert, reactors leak, there's no plan for long-term radioactive waste storage, and no site polluted with radiation has ever been completely cleaned up. And that puts all of us at risk. That is why you need a nuclear hot seat. We know where to look for the nuclear story. We know the questions to ask so that we can report on the ongoing, evolving nuclear truth that the industry would rather we not hear about, let alone understand. And let's face it, mainstream reporters don't know the questions to ask because they've received so much propaganda, they don't know to listen to us. That's why the time would be right now to support Nuclear Hot Seat with a donation. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button. That's where you can help us with a donation of any size. And that same red button is now where you can set up a monthly $5 donation. That's the same here in the United States as a cup of coffee and a nice tip to the barista. So, please, do what you can now. And know that however much you can help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. While the country is distracted by everything from the impending election to COVID-19 to Senate hearings on the Supreme Court replacement for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, not that anyone could truly replace her. In the American Southwest, forces are grinding forward to create so-called interim storage sites for the nation's dangerous, highly radioactive nuclear reactor waste. Both the Holtec-supported site in New Mexico and the Waste Control Specialist location in West Texas, just over the border from New Mexico, are problematic and inappropriate for a number of reasons, which today's guests will let us know all about. Leona Morgan is of the Diné people, in what the Western world thinks of as Arizona and New Mexico. She has worked with many anti-nuclear groups, including Hall No, and is co-founder of the Nuclear Issues Study Group, based in Albuquerque. Eileen O'Shaughnessy is a fourth-generation Irish-American educator, organizer, and musician living on stolen Tiwa land in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She teaches courses at the University of New Mexico, including Nuclear New Mexico, Social and Environmental Impacts, and Environmental Justice Practicum. In 2016, Eileen co-founded the Nuclear Issue Study Group with Leona Morgan. We spoke on Saturday, October 10, 2020. Leona Morgan and Eileen O'Shaughnessy, thank you so much for joining us here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Hi, Libby.
Hi, Libby. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Let's start with you, Leona. Paint the picture of the situation you are facing in New Mexico with the consolidated so-called interim storage facility, and how did it come about?
Well, I think it started when we started using nuclear energy for electricity, and a lot of the uranium that was used back in the Cold War era, all of that uranium mining now, it's both for weapons and energy, have also impacted our lands. And so for us, the issue of waste and nuclearism has started quite a long time ago. Today, we're dealing with two proposals to store the waste from nuclear power plants in New Mexico and Texas. Right now in New Mexico, we're facing the world's largest radioactive waste dump of the world's most toxic, deadly waste. And I'm talking about Holtec International, which plans to store 173,600 metric tons of high-level waste. Just quite simply, there's about 80,000 metric tons in the country right now, estimated. And so this is more than double the amount of waste that exists. We're not sure why they need such a large facility, but the idea is that this is supposed to be temporary until the federal government has a permanent place to put the waste from nuclear power plants. And so this idea of temporary implies that something will happen with Yucca. And right now we know Yucca Mountain is the named permanent repository, but it's never taken any waste, and we don't think it ever will. This is in Nevada. The state fought it politically. There are also many scientifically proven and technical issues with the site. Here in New Mexico, we know that if they bring the waste here, it most likely will not be temporary. We might be dealing with a permanent waste site that was built with specifications to be temporary. And so right now with Holtec, they're in the middle of the National Environmental Policy Act. They just finished a public comment period for the draft environmental impact statement. And the other proposal is by Waste Control Specialists, which is in partnership with Orana USA. And together, their application is under the name Interim Storage Partners. They are currently going through a public comment period. So folks can actually comment on this proposal to oppose it. And the deadline is November 3rd. And they're proposing to build a site for 40,000 metric tons. And again, these are two facilities, if you add up the capacity, is way more than we need here in the U.S. And so some of the concerns about WCS is that while they're in partnership with a French-based company, one of the major concerns is that they might import waste from France. So New Mexico and this part of Texas, it's right on the Texas, New Mexico-Texas state line. The Holtec proposal is near a water formation called Laguna Gatuna. And folks can just Google Laguna Gatuna, and to the west of it, when you're looking at it on your screen, you'll see the proposed location for Holtec International. Their proposal is to store the waste just below the surface, and Holtec is located only 13 miles north of the waste isolation pilot plant, which is a completely different site. It's a waste facility for weapons, and it's only 40 miles west of the proposed WCS site. WCS already has a facility in place that stores low-level radioactive waste and other hazardous materials, and it's along the New Mexico-Texas state line with some of its property in New Mexico. And so their proposal is to expand to include the high-level waste, and both places are within the Permian basins. There's a lot of issues with that, too, that we can talk about.
I just want to add a little bit more context to what Leona just shared. She began by saying that this issue originated with our country's decision to use nuclear energy to create power, and the way that that cycle, or nuclear fuel chain, as we call it, begins is by mining uranium out of the ground. And there's a longer history there that is connected to New Mexico in particular and to indigenous communities being targeted for that mining and for the waste from that mining that has never been addressed. And our group, the Nuclear Issues Study Group, we have a visualization that we can share with your listeners that's useful to kind of paint this picture. And in this visual, you can see on both coasts is the majority of the nuclear power plants in this country. And there are lines coming from both coasts directly to New Mexico and Texas, because that's where this waste would be traveling to. And at the same time, if we overlay a map that shows where the uranium was mined to create that nuclear energy, it's the same area of the country. It's New Mexico. It's the Southwest. And so what that means is it's a visualization of energy injustice, because the same uranium that was mined out of the ground to create that power in the Southwest was taken to the coast, and essentially those communities got the benefit of that power and created this deadly waste. And now the Southwest is being tasked with taking that waste, even though we don't have in New Mexico any commercial nuclear power plants. And by the way, neither does Nevada, which, you know, is ironic or not, or intentional for Yucca Mountain. So the thing I just want to point out is that this is not accidental. It's very intentional, and there's a term for it. It's environmental racism. The corridor and our opposition actually calls this area, southeastern New Mexico, calls it a nuclear corridor, and they proudly say that. But we find issue with that. This is an area that has been overburdened by nuclear colonialism. And just one statistic to share about the area where this Holtec site would be potentially placed, it's Eddy and Lee County, and it's 64.8% of the population identifies as people of color and predominantly Spanish-speaking folks. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, this process that we just went through of the draft environmental impact statement, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission failed to completely translate that document, that over 500-page document, into Spanish. That's racism right there, because it's essentially trying to dump waste on a community that's predominantly of color, and they're not providing accessible information about it. And so that's something that our group is passionate about, and we are attempting to raise an alarm about.
What is the latest in the fight to stop the consolidated so-called interim storage of nuclear waste, high-level nuclear waste, in New Mexico and Texas?
Our organization and many others have been focusing this summer on gathering public comments on the draft environmental impact statements. And both of those processes will be wrapped up here on November 3rd with the deadline of WCS's public comment period. And then the next step would be the final EIS as part of the National Environmental Policy Act. We have no idea when those will be ready, but essentially after that, assuming the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is going to approve, most likely Holtec, I'm not sure if they would approve both of them. We know that we need to continue to resist, and we need to continue working. Whether or not NRC does approve the license applications. And then after that, it will take a few years for construction if things are running smoothly. However, NRC has really bent over in the way to push forward these two proposals during an international crisis. And they originally, in 2018, during the public comment period for the scoping process, they had 5 in-person meetings in New Mexico for the Holtec application. And this year, they substituted those in-person meetings for webinars because of the pandemic. They could have quite simply have paused the process and waited until it was a safe time to gather in public again, which was requested by our entire congressional delegation. So in New Mexico, there is opposition from the elected officials, from the governor, from all of our folks in Congress, as well as legislators in the state. They all requested that NRC slow down, pause the process, and wait until it's safe for the public to come and learn about these projects and comment on the draft environmental impact statement. I mean, this is NEPA is where the public can become engaged. However, by substituting the in-person meetings, by not waiting and pushing it through, we see this as the NRC using the pandemic to their advantage and to the advantage of these corporations. We didn't see this happen on the WCS side. The application for their project, they actually paused the process a few years ago because they were having some legal challenges. And when they were done, the NRC let them pick up right where they left off and to continue their application process. And so we can see clearly that the NRC is very biased and working to actually support the nuclear industry, whereas when the public is trying to engage, these webinars have been effective at silencing the voices of those most impacted, because we're living in a state where a lot of folks live in rural locations and the internet connection is not always great. And to be on these webinars, you have to have an internet connection to see the slides, as well as a phone line to hear the audio and then to make comments. So we're in a state where not everybody has internet in the home, and even some places have spotty cell phone reception. And so it's been very challenging just to do outreach, for one thing, to get the word out, to tell people what's going on. Because of the pandemic, we're not able to do our normal activities. And this year, there was a lot lower participation on these webinars than there were when the meetings were in person. So these are some of the things happening now. We have the legal process also going alongside that. And the challenges, all of the opposition are we're working to protect our communities, but we're seen as the opposition or the interveners. We've submitted contentions opposing both projects in the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, where their judges are also NRC judges. So we're fighting a proposal within an agency that is designed to protect the industry. And so, of course, they threw all of our legal challenges out. And now both of them are, one is already for Holtec. We're very involved in that process. And it is now in the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. And so that's moving forward, as well as the WCS legal fight.
I'm always amazed at this living out of regulatory capture, that the NRC is completely captured by the industry it is supposed to regulate, and it does not do what it's supposed to do, which is protect people and the environment. Eileen, you had something you wanted to add?
I have to share that we as a group, you know, we've been in existence for 4 years now, and we've been a part of this process, this public process with the Holtec proposal and WCS since the beginning. And we've played by the rules, you know, we've submitted thousands of comments. We have sweated in the sun, gathering signatures at farmers markets. We've got the word out, submitted comments, the ways in which the NRC has asked. And we've sat through 5-hour long webinars that they have led, where the first people that are allowed to speak on these webinars, by the way, are the predominantly white businessmen from Eddy and Lee County who are in favor of this proposal. And that's who the NRC prioritizes. And I have to tell you, we're fed up, you know, and we as a group at one point during this process, when in the middle of this global crisis, as Leona said, this pandemic, when we realized that they were going to push through these webinars, we as a group were so frustrated, we decided we were going to boycott the rest of the webinars, even though we had participated up until this point, because we felt like it was silencing the voices of the public. And so what we did is we actually held our own, we called it a people's hearing. And we're a grassroots volunteer group. We shouldn't have to do that, you know? But we created a space that was much more democratic, that actually had Spanish translation. And, you know, we did our best to uplift the voices of the people. But essentially what the NRC is doing is squashing the democratic process, and they are refusing to listen to the people who are most impacted. And that is a crime.
It's not that you're without strong allies in this process. The governor of New Mexico, who you mentioned, Michelle Lujan Grisham, who is a Democrat, has been outspoken about not wanting this waste dump in her state for a long time. And now the surprise is that Texas Governor Gregory Abbott, who is a Republican, has also come out against the waste dump in West Texas. How did a Republican governor of Texas, of all states, and who is in alignment with the oil industry, come into alignment with this opposition to the consolidated so-called interim waste storage dumps?
Great question, Libby. I think this is part of this unfolding strange saga that we are living in the midst of, because essentially this corner of the country, southeastern New Mexico, in Western Texas, it's a conservative area, and this is an area of the country that has one of the highest percentages of oil and gas drilling in the entire country, the Permian Basin. So what we have here is a group of folks who feel very strongly that this industry is an economic boon and it needs to be protected from the possible presence of radioactive materials. So these are folks that we might not necessarily agree with politically, but they are on our side in this fight. And for example, this Republican governor has written a letter to President Trump opposing the WCS project, and that's great. You know, we're grateful for that. And our Democratic governor here in New Mexico has also come out in strong opposition. And I just want to point out how incredible this is. We have people on both sides of the aisle, the political aisle, coming out against this project in the area that it is cited to be placed to dump, and it's not mattering. And probably too, the NRC is still going to go ahead and license this project. So what does that tell us? It tells us that even governors, even states rising up and pushing back against these projects, to the NRC, it doesn't matter. They're still marching forward.
It's like they're on a track to reach a particular conclusion, and they don't care what's in their way, they're going to get there, which is not what they are supposed to be doing as a federal agency. It's supposed to be just the opposite of that. And this is not the first time that we've encountered the NRC's not even siding with the nuclear industry, but protecting it and promoting it. And we can get into issues on that at another time, but what I'd like to do here is shift the focus a little bit, because you've been talking about your group a lot, which is the Nuclear Issues Study Group. You've also mentioned at times that your work is to, quote, slay the nuclear beast. When and how did this incredible group, very powerful group, form? And what does your work consist of?
We are relatively new compared to some of the other anti-nuke groups that are out there. We started 4 years ago, and personally, I have started doing the work against uranium mining and learning about all of that since 2007, and that is what led me to learn more about the nuclear fuel chain. And so in 2012, I attended my first anti-nuke conference in Washington, D.C., and it was quite shocking for me to be in a room filled with mostly white folks. I started doing work as a student at the University of New Mexico, and I was working with mostly indigenous students, and I was also working in an indigenous social justice and environmental justice organization. So all of my training came from people of color and working on environmental justice issues and focusing on the impacts to indigenous peoples and sacred sites. So that's where my background is. That's where I came into the work as an individual. And then coming to the anti-nuke movement, some of these meetings I attended in the beginning, I was sitting in the room with a lot of white folks, mostly older, over the age of 50 and 60, largely from the East Coast, New England area, and then the Midwest. And I remember the first time I went to this meeting in Washington, D.C., that one had just a handful of people of color. And it was, I'll be honest, it was not a good experience. And over the years, getting to know some of these other folks and continuing on the path, talking to people, I saw that a lot of these people fighting nuclear energy issues had no idea about uranium mining. And they had no idea some of the impacts to my people. Of course, Diné people or Navajos it's well documented, some of the issues with uranium mining. But to actually know what it's like on the ground and the reality of these experiences I've had with my family, it was completely foreign to these people. I also got to know in the United States a little bit of the folks fighting weapons. So I saw this kind of divide between these movements and, you know, looking at how the nuclear industry was created by the United States federal government and how they compartmentalized everything, like they separated everything and did it in secrecy. And a lot of folks working on the Manhattan Project, you know, they were spread all over the country. They couldn't talk about it to their families. Well, we're kind of mimicking that in the movement. We've factionalized and we've separated the weapon side from the energy side. And there's also a division between the extractive industry of uranium mining and nuclear weapons development or nuclear energy. I see there are a lot of folks aware of the uranium mining, but then all of the steps in the middle as well. So our group, we try to design a space where we can have younger folks come in, be open to all of the different people who are impacted, especially in New Mexico, focusing largely on people of color, indigenous communities. We're women-led. We try to do things a little bit differently. But the main thing is our mission is everything. We work to protect New Mexico from all things nuclear. And so how do we do that? Well, we're still figuring that out. And I know Eileen can talk a little bit more about that.
Like Leona said, you know, we formed in 2016 out of a need to create a space where we could do work that was intersectional, which is a feminist term, you know, that was acknowledging that people have multiple identities, especially create a space where young folks can do this work and make it accessible to young people. That's definitely a passion of mine in particular. And to our knowledge, we are actually the only group in the entire country that is working on dismantling the entire nuclear fuel chain and is making space for young folks, which we don't want to be the only group, you know, but unfortunately that's the reality. And we center education, activism, and art in the work that we do. We try to have fun while we're doing it. We always want folks to join us in this good work because we're going to be around for a while, as long as the nuclear beast is around. And by the way, that term comes from, we often refer to ourselves as living in the belly of the beast here in New Mexico, because, you know, this industry technically began here. And so we refer to this dangerous, deadly industry as the nuclear beast, and we're trying to slay it as best we can.
It's good that you're planning on being around as long as we have this problem. 24,000 years half-life is just the short end of the estimation. So we're all going to be busy for a while and for many generations. You speak of needing to change the anti-nuclear movement. Why do you see that as necessary, and what would you envision it to look like?
This is why we formed our group. I've been part of other groups. I've participated in like I said, I attended several meetings and I kind of saw what was out there. And so when Eileen and I were getting ready to get this group started, there was a few other folks we were talking with, and it was very intentional how we put together our group. Eileen teaches a course at the university, and so we were really focused on getting younger folks and students, particularly, who were already concerned and already interested. And so these young people, some of them have joined our group and they stuck with us. A lot of them did projects and learned about the issue, and, you know, they focus on it in their studies. We utilized not only this avenue, this direct connection with young people through the university as well. And just by the way, we have no affiliation with the university whatsoever. We're not a part of the university. In fact, UNM is a nuclear research facility in itself, which I learned when I was a student there before I got involved in nuclear stuff. I honestly didn't know what that meant. When Eileen and I started talking about the group, yeah, we were very intentional about shifting how we work in this. Basically, it's a machine and the beast, as we call it. A lot of the anti-nuclear activists and organizers, we know a lot of the community, and we work with a lot of these folks, and we have a lot of respect for these folks. But something we noticed is that there's a small population of young people. And so we're still trying to understand why that is. And we're trying to do things in a different way that we're hoping all of the incredible knowledge and experience of the previous generations, the folks that are still in the fight, how do we transmit all of that knowledge to the future? So right now, you know, we just mentioned this issue is going to outlive us. And we, our little human lives are very short. We're a little blip in the lifespan of nuclear waste. And in order to continue the work into the future, we need to make sure that we are bringing in a new generation of young people. And because we don't see a strong presence of that right now, this is one of the areas where we know there needs to be change, as well as involving more frontline community folks, more people of color. And so I think in a way, I will say this for myself individually, I have a lot of privilege even as a person of color. I went to college, grew up in a house that had running water and electricity. I have a passport, I can travel. So there's a lot of privilege that I hold. But for some reason, I think part of being an anti-nuclear activist and that access to technology and education in itself is also very privileged. And so one of the things that we've also been striving to do is make the issues and the language of nuclear accessible. And my personal dream and vision, I know our organization, we do have some ideas about what the future looks like. I'm just going to speak as an individual that I want every New Mexican to know what New Mexico is about and how many nuclear facilities we have here. And in the way that we love our state, and you know, a lot of people have a strong and very long heritage here. There's a lot of indigenous communities, a lot of the, you know, Chicano and Latinx communities with long lineages in the state. This is our home. You know, we love this place. And as much as we love New Mexico, that needs to be synonymous with, we don't want nukes here. We don't want any more nuclear weapons facilities. We don't want any more waste. We want all the waste cleaned up. But there's a strong lack of information in the general public. And that's one of the things that needs to be fixed. I think every person in this country and the world needs to know what this is. It's not only an issue of environmental justice or racism, but the reality is we make it possible as taxpayers. And we can stop it. I think a lot of folks don't like to hear the word nuclear, and their eyes, you can see it in their eyes when you're talking to them. So this, to me, that is my dream, that when you say the word nuclear, it doesn't have this aversion, but it has this other impact that people know. You know, in my language, we just say doda or iya. That's what I want people to have, you know, this kind of sense of when you say the word nuclear. How do we make that happen? Well, it's not happening through handouts and websites with, you know, just polluted with so many words. And that's one of the things Eileen mentioned with focusing more on art and music. Last night we had our first art event, and our group is focusing more on this in this route. And if we can change the way we transmit information with imagery and music and things like that, it might be a lot more palpable to the general public. And so I know this happened already in the 80s. Maybe we're just reinvigorating it and reprocessing it. But yeah, there's a lot of changes that need to happen, and we're trying to explore what is effective and how can we help with that.
We use humor in our work, and we also, I think, come from a place of mutual care for one another in our group. And anybody who's ever done community organizing knows that it's difficult to work together sometimes. And so cultivating relationships and dealing with personalities and things like that, it's part of the work. I want to just address that question that you asked, which I think is a really good question about what is our vision, especially with the anti-nuclear movement. For me, it's similar to Leona, but I mean, I'm coming from a different vantage point in a lot of ways. I'm white, Irish American. My ancestors are from Ireland predominantly. I'm fourth generation. And I moved to New Mexico 10 years ago specifically to study this industry, but I'm very aware that I'm not from here. And there's a complication with that in just acknowledging the violent history of colonization and the stealing of indigenous lands, because that's part of nuclearism. But I would just say that I came at this work kind of through the peace movement because I was raised Catholic and I became disenchanted with some of the sexism and homophobia as a queer person within Catholicism. But what I loved was the radical history within Catholicism of the nuns and the priests who were tying themselves to nuclear weapons and pouring fake blood on nuclear weapons like the Berrigan brothers. Those are my people, you know, I love them. But I have to say that there's really, like Leona said, I too noticed that it was predominantly older white folks, you know, who were in this movement. I say that with a lot of love. Like, I want to honor our elders too and honor the people who came before us and built a foundation within this movement. But I just think we're in a moment where we're growing and we're finding a way to translate this information, this really valuable information that exists within the anti-nuclear movement, to the next generation, right? And I just want to point out that the doomsday clock, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, there are two major threats that moved that clock the closest to midnight, and that's climate change and nuclear war. And that impacts everyone. So I think we have to find a way to translate and communicate that to everyone. You know, for some reason, climate change, I think, gets communicated easier, or people, especially young people, are sort of more attuned with that in this country. But those are twin threats. And nuclear in particular is a threat that is going to be with us, as we've talked about, for a very long time.
It's clear that you are both dedicated to this, as is your group, and that you're not going to be going away from it. So the question then becomes, what's next, and how might the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat help you?
We definitely need a lot of time ourselves to figure out what's next, especially in the country with what's happening with all of the different uprisings against racism, against fascism, what's going to happen after the election. We're dealing with this pandemic, which totally disrupts our way of organizing. And so our organization is looking at how do we continue when we're working with, it's an all-volunteer group. And as young people, many of our members have school and work. And how do we operate in this world with all of these things happening? And so we're definitely trying to transition into things that make this work possible. One thing we did this summer was we focused on this webinar series. We did 6 webinars, as well as the people's hearing that Eileen mentioned. They all live on the internet. We're working on our website. We want to have a little bit more of an interactive way to communicate with people, even though we're in this digital, we're very concerned about the virus. And so we are not meeting in public at all. And so this is something that we have to completely shift how we operate. But I think it'll be for the best, because a lot of our younger folks joining are amazing at social media and some of the online tools that we can use. So we do hope that your listeners will be interested in some of the activities we'll be putting out next year. The major things that are happening are the WCS comment period. There's going to be some things happening next year with WIP. And we do need people to stay involved and to contact their elected officials. Even though the deadline for Holtec has passed, that doesn't mean that people are not at risk. And so we urge everyone to be active in whatever capacity they can be, whether it's going to town hall meetings or going to their own organizations and talking about these issues. And of course, talking to their congressional officials is important, because these are all regulated by the federal NRC. The major thing is that we want people to be informed. And so even if they're not politically active, this is the number one thing as a study group. We ourselves, I think, are going to take a more introspective approach to some of this and really dissect these issues, especially in New Mexico, because there's so many. And we've only scratched the surface of one major issue today, which was Holtec and WCS, both consolidated interim storage facility proposals. But there's a lot more. And so we're assessing how do we do that in this political and social and this world that we're living in.
I just want to point out that we are in a moment of adaptation, as is every species on planet Earth right now. You know, we're all trying to adapt to the changes that are rapidly coming. And I think we as a group are figuring out how to maintain this work. Our mission, again, is to protect New Mexico from all things nuclear through art, education, and activism, and sustain the work. So I think it's something that we are living through, and we're certainly shifting to address. I do want to just point out two important dates for your listeners, because as Leona mentioned, the WCS fight is not over, and people can still submit comments, actually, up until, of all dates, November 3rd. Is when WCS, the deadline is, and I would just submit that that's probably not accidental. But there is one more webinar hosted by the NRC this Thursday morning at 8 a.m. Pacific time. And if your listeners go to the NRC website, and if you can navigate all of that bureaucracy on their website, they don't make it easy, but you should be able to find some kind of a link to join and submit an official comment in opposition to the WCS site, and we encourage you to do so. And thank you so much, Libby, for allowing us to share this information.
And I want to point out that the Thursday that you're talking to is October 15th.
You're right, October 15th, and it'll start at 8 a.m. in the morning. You can go to this website. It's easy to remember. NuclearWaste.org, and then you can find all the information to connect, and they usually run about 2 hours or more. So the first 30 minutes will be the NRC's presentation, but the important time to join is during the public comment part where they take calls.
And I wish to point out that when you said 8 a.m., that would be in Pacific time. It would be 11 a.m. on the East Coast, Eastern time, and make the adjustment for whatever time zone you happen to be in. Leona Morgan and Eileen Shaughnessy, you're doing phenomenal work. Your group, the Nuclear Issue Study Group, is doing important work, and you're setting a model for what can happen in other parts of the country as well when motivated activists reach out to the younger community with communications that they can understand about nuclear. I think that's sometimes our biggest challenge, is how do we translate all of this highly technical and complex gobbledygook into something that people can grasp in little sound bites. Hopefully we'll be able to do that translation and get a lot more people involved. But for now, I want to thank you so much for making yourselves available and being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby. It was, once again, a great show, and we really appreciate your program. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, Libby. And we just want to say we love your show, and we love the theme music.
Thanks for that. That was Leona Morgan and Eileen O'Shaughnessy of the Nuclear Issues Study Group. Their website is currently under construction, so you can find out more about them and the actions they wish you to take by going to their Facebook group, which is Nuclear Issues Study Group. Remember, you have until November 3rd to send comments to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission about the proposed waste site in West Texas.
Activists, shout out.
After many delays, the sentencing of the last six of the Plowshare 7 activists is currently scheduled on October 15 or 16 in the early afternoon. This would be for Father Steve Kelly and Patrick O'Neill. These seven activists were convicted of three felonies and one misdemeanor 1 year ago in October for their Nonviolent Symbolic Disarmament Act at the Kings Bay Trident Nuclear Submarine Base. 80-year-old Elizabeth McAllister has already been released with time served, and the remaining four defendants, Carmen Trotta, Martha Hennessy, Mark Colville, and Claire Grady, were granted continuances until November 12 and 13 because of COVID-19 issues. We wish them all well with time served and release.
And the International Uranium Film Festival opens on Thursday, October 15 in Berlin, Germany. This traveling film festival is the only one of its kind in the world that highlights all nuclear and radioactive issues. Nuclear fuel chain, uranium mining, atomic bombs, nuclear power plants, nuclear waste deposits, everything from Hiroshima to Fukushima. To find out more and learn how you can help bring the IUFF to your community, we will have a link up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 486. You can also search them out by going to their website, uraniumfilmfestival.org. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 13, 2020. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, Beyond Nuclear International, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, democracynow.org, thebulletin.org, outrider.org, ocregister.com, fairwinds.org, nikkei.com, reuters.com, mainichi.jp, abc27.com, nhk.or.jp, ScienceAlert.com, Futurism.com, UPI.com, FT.com, CleanEnergy.org, HeraldScotland.com, ThePrint.in, Plowshares.org, and the ever-co-opted Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Hey, did you know that there are over 485 episodes of Nuclear Hot Seat that we've got parked on our website, nuclearhotseat.com? You can search them by number, you can search them by date, you can search them by topic, and we invite you to do so. This is our ongoing weekly record, 9.5 years of evolution of this movement, and interviews with experts in all aspects of the field. So we welcome you to go and poke around and learn what you can at nuclearhotseat.com. And going forward, if you want to make certain that you miss not a single episode of the show, at that same website, you scroll down to the yellow box, fill in your first name and your email address, and you will get one email a week. We don't bug you. It's just the one that includes a link to each week's episode, and it goes up as soon as the episode posts. Or if you prefer, go to your favorite podcast platform. You can get Nuclear Hot Seat there as well. There is never a week without nuclear news, and you need to know what those industry tricksters are up to now. Speaking of which, we rely on our listenership to make us aware of the stories in your area. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate and have come to count on weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to go to nuclearhotseat.com, look for that big red button, click on it, follow the prompts, and do what you can to help us out. We really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2020. Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications, all rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hartestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we can always come up with the date that a nuclear emergency begins, but we can never come up with a date that it's over, because once it starts, it is never over. There you go. That is your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.
Mm-hmm.